this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Cisco sends bullish signal about local ops. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far left, there's a picture of a man standing in front of some equipment. The caption reads, Ed Paradise heads up Cisco Systems operations in the Triangle. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Research Triangle Park. Even as Cisco Systems CEO John Chambers was ordering more than $1 billion in expense cuts company-wide during 2011, the company continued to invest in upgrades to its East Coast outpost in Research Triangle Park. In the past year, more than $14.2 million has been spent on building upgrades, additions, and alterations among Cisco's 12 office buildings in RTP. According to a review of building permits issued in Wake County, construction crews with R.N. Rouse & Company, Incorporated have been kept busy building new high-density labs for Cisco's engineers and making improvements to office space across the campus, confirms Kirsten Weeks, Cisco Systems' Senior Community Relations Manager. That speaks to Cisco Systems' confidence in its workforce and operations in RTP, says Liz Rooks, vice president of the Research Triangle Foundation, which manages the park. Anytime you see investment in a property, it speaks to that company's satisfaction with where they are, she says. We're very happy to see this investment is being made. Cisco Systems is the second largest employer behind IBM in RTP, with about 5,000 employees and contractors working at the campus. Week says, which is a larger figure than the 4,900-person employee count that the company had quoted a year ago. After working to make the company more lean during 2011, Chambers appears to have Cisco poised to once again contribute to job growth nationally as well as in the Triangle. Company CFO Frank Calderoni says Cisco added 400 people during the second fiscal quarter, with a total headcount now at 63,870. That was driven primarily by growth in advanced services, technical services, and strategic engineering hiring, which was also partially offset by the remaining actions of our workforce restructuring, Calderoni noted during a conference call with analysts in February. The company's $1 billion expense reduction plan was achieved one quarter ahead of schedule. And just because Cisco is adding employees does not mean it is not aware of its expenses. As of last quarter, every Cisco employee, on an average, accounted for $180,000 in sales during the quarter. The average expense for a Cisco employee during the same time, $61,406. And if one looks at the trends in the past three quarters, the sales per employee number is going up and the expense per employee number is going down. Oppenheimer & Company analyst Itai Kidron listened to Chambers during the company's latest conference call and came out with a bullish outlook a day later. The company's router business, one of RTP's main product lines, is growing and so are the gross margins. We don't expect momentum to slow down, Kidron says. We continue to be impressed with Cisco's solid execution. Kidron does not own any Cisco shares, but his company makes a market in Cisco stock. Looking forward to future quarters, there may be a downside to Cisco's RTP operation, which houses a large software research and development operation. After sitting with Chambers on February 28 at an analyst roundtable discussion, Wells Fargo Securities analyst Jess Lubert says the company seems to be focused on growing profit faster than sales. Given this scenario, we believe Cisco may need to make tough decisions regarding where to allocate R&D budget going forward, Lubert says. States in his latest research note. And we move down the page, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal for our next article. This one has a black border around it. Inside of that, the background is an olive green. The top half has a picture, and it's a picture over the shoulder looking down at someone working in a lab with some very high-tech equipment in front of them and a keyboard. The caption reads, Merck's state-of-the-art plant in Durham is going full throttle, says plant manager John Wagner. And then under that in bold red lettering is the headline, Torrid Growth, Merck Plant Outpacing Job Projections. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Durham. North Carolina's unemployment rate is still hovering near 10%. But don't tell that to pharmaceutical giant Merck and Company. By the end of this year, Merck will grow its Durham vaccine-producing plant to 1,000 employees, higher than previous estimates and nearly five times larger than the workforce at the beginning of 2010. We're hiring at a pace of close to 30 a month, says John Wagner, Merck's Durham plant manager, who himself in 2010 estimated the workforce would grow only to 750 by the end of 2012. Now at three shifts per day, the extra work is needed to meet demand as the Durham facility checks off various U.S. Food and Drug Administration approvals. Since 2010, the Durham facility has been partially manufacturing Verifax, a childhood vaccine to combat chickenpox, but splits manufacturing duties with a plant in Pennsylvania. Early next year, Durham hopes to receive approval to manufacture Verifax from start to finish, Wagner says. Looking out toward 2014, Merck hopes to achieve other FDA approvals. When fully licensed, the facility will manufacture parts of Zostafax, a vaccine for shingles in older adults, MMR2 for measles, mumps, and rubella, and Proquad for measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox. Through the first three quarters, sales of those vaccines combined were on a pace to generate more than $1.5 billion in 2011. In 2010, the vaccines had combined sales of $1.6 billion. Merck did not record any sales of Proquad in the second quarter or third quarter of 2011, which had made up the smallest portion of sales in the previous quarters. Although Merck is relocating some production work from Pennsylvania to North Carolina, union leaders in Pennsylvania are not concerned, says Fred Redman, the international vice president for the United Steelworkers, which represents 800 workers at the Merck facility in West Point, Pennsylvania. We don't see this as a shift to work from a unionized state to a non-unionized state, he says. For now, we aren't concerned. Although already in production, the Durham plant, known as the Maurice R. Hilleman Center for Vaccine Manufacturing, is just now nearing full build-out. It's a 700,000-square-foot facility named for the scientist credited with developing more life-saving vaccines than anyone else. Officials there will interview 95 candidates for bioprocess technician positions and production associates from a screened pool of applicants. Since construction began in 2004, Merck has invested nearly $1 billion in the Durham facility, says Chesney Johnson, Merck's global communications manager. And now our last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal runs vertically along the right side of the page. At the top, there's a picture of a man standing casually dressed in front of a BioLex sign. The caption reads, Jan Turek heads up BioLex Therapeutics. And then under that, the headline, Selling BioLex Now an Option. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Durham. BioLex Therapeutics needs money to further develop its hepatitis treatment to the point that selling the company has become an option, confirms Chief Financial Officer Dale Sander. We're in a process of discussing with various pharma partners how to take this drug forward, he says, adding that a sale of the company could occur, but there wouldn't be any comment until that actually happens. At a minimum, we would hope to bring on new partners. Under a partnership, BioLex could continue developing the drug while the other company would stand ready to commercialize it should it gain approval. Any sale likely would be to a large pharma seeking to add products to its pipeline. BioLex, a clinical stage company, has raised about $190 million so far, but Sander would not say how much more is needed. Much of BioLex stock is held by venture capital firms and corporate shareholders such as Johnson & Johnson, Sander says. VC investors include Polaris, Venture Partners, and Quaker BioVentures. At its peak a few years ago, BioLex employed about 70. A company representative recently said the employee count is now 13. BioLex CEO Jan Turek offers no additional comment on BioLex financing and will not disclose how much he thinks BioLex is worth or how much capital the company would hope to net in a sale. Founded in 1997, BioLex produces human proteins from the Lemna plant, a type of duckweed. BioLex's lead drug candidate, Loctarin, is a controlled-release treatment for hepatitis, a treatment Sanders calls a principal improvement over drugs currently on the market because it's delivered to patients once every 2 weeks instead of every week and works without side effects typically associated with the drug class. Phase 2B trials last year were promising, he says, leading to preparations for Phase 3 trials, but those can't happen without money. BioLex needs to invest in material and hardware in advance of the next round of human clinical trials, he says. With Loctarin currently taking a breather from trials, the company cash burn rate has lessened, Sanders says, but he would not say how much money BioLex is spending. He also would not identify companies BioLex is considering for partnerships or a sale, but he did say the company is looking for like-minded firms currently working in hepatitis products or companies already actively marketing such drugs. Chip Galluli, Vice President of Corporate Development for Quintiles, is not familiar with BioLex's situation, but he has orchestrated partnerships such as an alliance finalized in December between Quintiles and Intarsia to develop a diabetes treatment candidate. Such an arrangement is an efficient way to push forward innovation, he says. The industry is struggling to reinvent itself in many ways, he notes. Large pharma companies certainly have an awful lot of cash on their hands, but they're struggling to get their pipelines filled with new drugs. That's where companies like BioLex are essential to the master plan, he says. As pharma companies deal with budget issues on one side of the spectrum, smaller outfits like BioLex often struggle to get as much cash as they can to progress. Quintiles alone has forged more than 90 partnerships or alliances since 2000 and has invested just under $2.5 billion, either in money or services, says Quintiles Director of Corporate Development, Sam Osman. The World Health Organization estimates that as many as 170 million people worldwide are chronically infected with hepatitis C and anticipate 4 million new cases each year. BioLex has two other product candidates, one to dissolve blood clots and another an antibody. The company tried to go public in 2007, but the deal never materialized. BioLex's corporate office is in Durham, and its research facility is in Pittsburgh. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, it's about health, retiree says of 3,000-mile walk. And there's a picture of a man walking along a roadway. The caption says, Colin Terrell is promoting a healthy lifestyle. Colin Terrell is off for a good cause. The retired president of Greystone Bank in Raleigh on March 1 began a trek from Cape Hatteras and intends to keep walking west for some 3,000 miles until he reaches Santa Monica, California. Why, you may ask? He wants to raise awareness and funding for heart health. Terrell knows firsthand the importance of a healthy heart, having had a major heart attack and open-heart 5 bypass surgery in 2009. He subsequently became an advocate for promoting a heart-healthy lifestyle. If my walk results in even one person making a positive lifestyle change, the effect will be well worthwhile, says Terrell. Those hoping to hear Salix Pharmaceuticals CEO Carolyn Logan give more detail about her company's corporate scuffle with Napo Pharmaceuticals were disappointed at the end of the Raleigh-based drugmaker's annual earnings conference call. We believe that their lawsuit is baseless, without merit, and we are continuing to go forward, was her response to a question from an analyst on the matter. Logan and the other top executives did not take questions from reporters and did not respond to questions after the call. Napo, based in California, and Salix hammered out an agreement to jointly bring a new gastrointestinal drug, crefelomer, to market. In Napo's opinion, Salix did not hold up its end of the bargain. It filed a lawsuit against the larger company and tried to take back the intellectual property for the drug. Salix has continued to move forward and filed a new drug application with the Food and Drug Administration after Napo filed its lawsuit. For 3 years, since 2009, when celebrants climbed and essentially sucked the life out of a tree on Franklin Street, the remaining stub has stood, the handiwork of a local craftsman who fashioned it into an arm holding a basketball. The tree met its Waterloo when some 4,500 Tar Heel fans rushed Franklin Street to celebrate the Tar Heels' 2009 national championship in men's basketball. I was up on a roof at Spanky's that night, and there were five or six guys on that tree, and I knew it was doomed, Greg Overbeck, co-owner of Spanky's Restaurant and Bar, told the Daily Tar Heel. Dwight Bassett, Chapel Hill's Economic Development Director, stepped in and carved the tree, which came to be called the Championship Tree. Alas, weather has taken its toll on the sculpture, which has been carted off to a dry place. In its place, a new tree has been planted. Get fit and let everyone know you're doing it. That will be the gig this spring when outdoor fitness classes will be offered in downtown Raleigh's City Plaza through a partnership between the Downtown Raleigh Alliance and O2 Fitness. 4 or 5 times a week, instructors from O2 will assemble those interested and offer group classes and exercises including yoga, shabam, body combat, and Zumba. The classes are free to O2 Fitness and DRA members. Biz and drivers on Glenwood Avenue got a sneak peek at the PNC Financial signage on a windy day last week. Taking a page out of the Wells Fargo playbook, PNC covered all its new signs with banners that read RBC Bank USA, the bank it is taking over. A banner on the PNC building across Glenwood from Crabtree Valley Mall came loose, however, giving any passersby a glimpse at the new signs. Starting Saturday, March 3, more than 400 RBC branches in 6 states, including 33 in the Triangle, will convert to the PNC brand. Developers of the proposed 169-unit Searstone Continuing Care Retirement Community in Cary have been given an extension until March 31 to present a permanent financing plan for the project to the North Carolina Department of Insurance. The plan was due on February 24 but was delayed so the developers, Atlanta-based Samaritan Housing Foundation Incorporated, can work on the details of a $114 million bond financing package, says DOI's Steve Johnson. Searstone, which has been pre-selling units in the development, is to be a retirement community for residents age 62 and older. Well, who knew? Not Biz. But we'll all now know that the North Carolina Museum of History in downtown Raleigh houses one of the nation's largest collections of Confederate flags. To help preserve these historical banners, the museum has partnered with the 26th Regiment North Carolina Troops Reactivated, the state's largest Civil War reenactment group. Not only is the group helping preserve flags already in the collection, members have presented to the museum a flag it helped preserve, the battle flag of the 16th Regiment North Carolina Troops. Carried into the Battle of Gettysburg, the flag was captured during the Pickett Pettigrew Trimble charge on July 3, 1863, by a soldier from the 14th Connecticut Volunteers. The regiment's colors were sent to the U.S. War Department in Washington, D.C., and returned to North Carolina in 1905. With private funding support from organizations and individuals, the museum has now conserved or has the funding to conserve 14 flags in its collection. A vacant restaurant space on Buck Jones Road near Cary has been turned into a meeting venue called Cypress Manor that can accommodate 500 guests for cocktail events and more than 300 for dinners. Renovations were carried out between March 2011 and January 2, 2012, when the venue opened. Built in 2000, the space originally was home to a Bullwinkle's restaurant and then to a Six String Cafe. The space is managed by Sean Schindler, owner of Special Events Management Company. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance has presented its annual Imprint Awards, recognizing significant contributions to fostering the evolving identity of downtown Raleigh. This year's winners, recognized at a gala on the evening of February 23, are Contemporary Art Museum, Alfred Williams & Company Headquarters, The Corner Shop, Chef Ashley Christensen Restaurants, The Wilmore Building, Carter Worthy and Tom Hester, and AIA North Carolina Center for Architecture and Design. The Distinguished Leadership Award went to former Mayor Charles Meeker. The Downtown Advocate Award was presented to Robert Pierce Jr., Assistant Zoning Enforcement Administrator, City of Raleigh. "We want queso," screamed the Caniacs. And queso they got, with 1,507 fans redeeming their ticket stubs for free servings, in fact. In any home game in which the Carolina Hurricanes score 5 goals, Moe's Southwest Grill gives away free sides of queso. After the Canes beat the Washington Capitals 5-0 at the RBC Center on February 13, fans got their free cheese with the final Caniac queso count coming to 1,507 servings. "That's awesome," defenseman Brian Allen said after the game, but was more happy about the win than the cheese. "In general, to put a good performance in front of the fans is great," he says. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Lee Weisbecker. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article has the headline, "Growing Loan Demand Spurs TCAP Cash Rush." And next to this article, there is a picture of a man sitting at a desk in an office wearing a tie. The caption reads, "Garland Tucker III founded and runs Triangle Capital Corporation." This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Raleigh. Raleigh-based specialty business lender Triangle Capital Corporation's race to rake in new cash is being viewed as a signal that vitality is returning to the economy. Using a variety of techniques, TCAP raises money that it then uses to make loans to credit-hungry, mid-market private companies that are looking to grow. Starting in the fourth quarter and continuing into 2012, says Morgan Keegan analyst Robert Todd, business development companies like TCAP began to see a spike in demand for cash, a clear sign of a business uptick. "They have been looking at very, very strong levels of demand," says Dodd, "and the expectations are high going into the new year." The response of TCAP, founded by Raleigh businessman Garland Tucker III, has been to stock its war chest through the sale of stock and notes and by signaling a line of credit with banks, by signing a line of credit with banks. Since August, it's raised something on the order of $203 million and nearly $316 million over the past 12 months. Says Davenport analyst David West, "They wouldn't be raising money unless they had a place to put it." Asked for a comment, Triangle Capital CFO Steve Lilly declined, making reference to the quiet period preceding the company's next quarterly report. "I will look forward to catching up after we file our 10-K, he says. Triangle Capital's core business model is a simple one. The company raises money as cheaply as possible and lends it out at rates of interest that produce a margin of profit. Case in point, TCAP will pay investors 7% a year on the up to $69 million in corporate notes it is now in the process of selling to investors, and then lend the cash it takes into the middle market clients at 12% to 17%. The company generates revenue in another way. It often accepts shares of stock or stock warrants from the companies to which it lends. If the portfolio companies do well and those shares rise in value, TCAP wins again on the same loan. As of September 30, 2011, Triangle Capital had investments totaling $464 million in 60 companies, ranging from automotive parts suppliers to metal fabricators, baked goods distributors, and lab testing services. Loans that subsequently went on to become non-repaying problems are currently around $7 million, or 1.5% of the company's portfolio, according to documents filed to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission by the company. TCAP has just declared its consecutive quarterly dividend, and its shares in the $19.65 range are trading near the firm's 52-week high of $20.23. Playing into the company's hands in recent months has been the conservative lending policies of banks. Whether TCAP's portfolio growth and bottom line will suffer when that lifts is the $64,000 question, says Dodd, adding, TCAP is in the mezzanine space and should be all right, but time will tell. And for our next article, we move to the center of the same page, an article with a black border around it. Inside that border, the top third is a picture of an older gentleman talking with some students at Duke University, all casually dressed, standing outside of a building. The caption reads, "Duke University President Richard Broadhead chats with students on campus." Then under that is the headline, "Call 'em alum bucks despite economy, giving up at UNC and Duke." And then below that is the article. But in the lower left-hand corner, there's also a graph that's headlined Recession Smucession. And it says, even during the dark days of the Great Recession, alums and others kept giving to universities. And then under that, there's the totals for 2006, 2010, and 2011 for Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, Stanford, and Harvard. And those are some of the numbers we'll discuss in the article. This article was written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Chapel Hill. Philip Blumberg, chairman and CEO of Blumberg Capital Partners in Coral Gables, Florida, says he simply wanted to give back to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where three consecutive generations of his family have gone to college. He isn't alone. In terms of total annual fundraising, UNC Chapel Hill is gaining on Duke University and its legion of well-off alums. Comparing 2006 to 2011, UNC Chapel Hill has experienced a 16% increase in dollars given, while Duke has seen a 5% increase. Of course, in total dollars, Duke still received more gifts. In fact, its $350 million raised in 2011 ranked 12th in the nation, while UNC Chapel Hill's $275 million ranked 19th. In comparison, NC State University received $94 million in gifts and new commitments, including $82 million in receipts, a 19% increase from the prior year. Blumberg, who was profiled in a UNC Office of University Development report, says he wanted to support the university to improve both the physical campus and campus life. Donation figures are compiled by the Council for Aid to Education, which releases stats on the nation's top 20 fundraising institutions. Nationally, colleges and universities raised $30 billion in 2011, an 8% increase over 2010, as state budget cuts continue to plague public higher education in North Carolina and other states. Campus leaders say charitable giving is more important than ever in order to provide financial aid, retain professors, and continue high-level research and innovation. As with other nonprofits, the large majority of charitable giving is concentrated at the top. In fact, 86% of money given, or $25 billion, went to only one quarter of all universities. The bottom half of fundraising institutions combined for less than 5% of all giving. Other national trends show that foundations made up about 29% of donations and alumni accounted for about 26% in 2011. Although Duke experienced only a 1% increase in 2011 over 2010, fundraising staff say they are poised for big gains in the coming years. The CAE numbers report money that was actually collected in that year, but Duke also received several large pledges. Combining gifts received with pledges, Duke actually saw a 45% increase, one of the largest increases ever. Duke already has received some large gifts this year, including the largest ever, from individuals to support financial aid, a $50 million donation from Bruce and Martha Karsh. Bruce Karsh, president of Oak Tree Capital Management in Los Angeles, is a 1977 Duke graduate and a member of the university's Board of Trustees. The timing of major gifts, all of which are in development typically for many years, plays a large role in these year-to-year rankings, says Mike Schoenfeld, Duke's vice president for communications. Overall, we are very optimistic about financing and have seen a strong recovery from the depths of the recession, with many more major donors interested in making significant long-term commitments to the university. When thinking about fundraising, UNC does not set a specific target for donation size. Fundraising staff actively seek annual fund gifts as well as major gifts, says Scott Ragland, the director of UNC Development Communications. He says donors who make regular annual gifts can sometimes become major donors. Aurelian's Help for Homeland Tourist Resort. That's the headline of our next article, this one written by Lauren K. Onsorge, and the dateline is Research Triangle Park. Symetrica CEO Jean Orleans' latest mission isn't in biotechnology. Rather, it's in rebuilding Haiti from the inside out after it was mangled in a 7.0 quake in 2010. Aurelian left his native land in 1980 for opportunity and found plenty, starting Symetrica in 2001, a company now with more than 70 local employees and with offices in Virginia and Georgia, besides Research Triangle Park. Success, however, couldn't cushion the shock of seeing reports in January of the earthquake on his work computer. By the time he reached a television, casualty reports were in the thousands. Indescribable, he says, I knew I had to go back. Instead of adding to the dozens of aid workers already in Haiti, Aurelien looked at the situation through the lens of a businessman. People need to understand that there's no country that has ever, to my knowledge, ever successfully taken itself out of misery with pure aid, he says. Create jobs and education and health care will follow, he says. While standing on the shore of untouched Luc Azay 2 years ago, he thought of a way to do it, by capitalizing on one of Haiti's best assets, sunshine. He made a decision. He would build a lakeshore resort community in Haiti. He's brought in local developer Randy Bose of Carolina Properties, is lining up $10 million to build the 130-room resort, and expects it will create at least 500 jobs when it opens. Bose, whose first trip to Haiti ended 2 weeks ago, says humanitarianism compelled him to participate, but it's the setting that will make the project successful. He plans to help create a destination type of environment, similar in some ways to another project he worked on, Broadway at the Beach in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. But this is a whole different set of rules and circumstances that really puts my skills to the test, he says. Haitian-born architect Yves Louis Charles heard about the project from his priest in New York and developed plans for the resort pro bono out of duty. After not taking a step in Haiti for 20 years, Louis Charles went back at Orleans' request and is now involved in several development projects on the island, which Haiti shares with the Dominican Republic. Getting a return on his investments isn't Louis Charles's end game. His return, he says, will come in seeing his country succeed. Orlean believes the resort can be profitable for investors. The money is coming from two prime sources. $2 million from private equity, with about a fourth already raised, he says, and the remaining $8 million being raised from international financiers. Delayed by Haitian land title regulations, Orlean expects to break ground in July of 2013. The project would cost double, he says, if it were built in the United States. Laborers in Haiti work for about $5 a day, he notes, adding that money goes farther on the island. Once the hotel is built, he foresees adding apartments and townhomes. Developers are starting to perceive value in Haiti, Orlean says. Marriott just invested $40 million in a hotel in Port-au-Prince, and a manufactured housing project was underway during his last visit. Following the earthquake, the country's GDP contracted by an estimated 5.1%, but it is growing again. Central Intelligence Agency estimates put the 2011 GDP at $12.44 billion, up 6.1% from 2010's $11.73 billion. Jobs are badly needed in the nation, which has an estimated unemployment rate of 40.6%. Mark St. Clair of Boston-based Haiti Ventures, a firm founded after the earthquake to match investors and investment opportunities in Haiti, hopes projects such as Orleans will help make the island more competitive with its Caribbean neighbors for tourism. I could see other industries develop, he explains, mentioning tourist activities such as diving and fishing, along with transportation to get people around. UNC Chapel Hill economist Patrick Conway says it could work. Many countries have relied upon tourism as a way to attract consumers and to expand parts of their economy, he says. It is an opportunity for paid employment in a country that has great unemployment numbers. In our next article, is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, State's $320,000 pay may not be enough to lure advisor. The state will soon begin dangling its highest non-academic salary, $320,000, to attract a new chief investment officer for North Carolina's $72 billion pension fund. The question is, will that be enough to draw top talent? In neighboring Virginia, pension recruiters recently found it necessary to bump their base pay offer by 42% to $365,000 to land a new CIO, and Virginia's pension fund at $52 billion is nearly 30% smaller than that of the Tar Heel state. And while the amount paid to North Carolina's CIO eclipses even that of the governor, It pales when compared to the amount paid, for example, to Jonathan King for managing UNC Chapel Hill's $2.5 billion endowment. King was paid $983,764, according to UNC Management Company's 2010 tax filing, the most recent available. Officials in charge of the North Carolina CIO hunt, which is prompted by the departure of investment head Sean Wishmeyer, will take a reading of current salary levels being paid in the public pension fund market. The department will take into consideration both a current market salary review and the candidate pool when determining the salary for the position, says Julia Vail of State Treasurer Janet Cowell's office. Wishmeyer has accepted the job of overseeing the investing for a $6 billion Wisconsin-based charity, joining a list of more than 15 U.S. public pension CIOs who have resigned over the past 26 months, many for corporate or nonprofit jobs, according to Chicago-based Pension and Investments magazine's Kevin Olson and other magazine staffers. Until now, North Carolina's $320,000 salary for the job had been viewed as at the high end of the base pay compensation scale for public pension investment leaders. That scale range recently from about $165,000 to $300,000, according to P&I magazine. In North Carolina, the CIO's salary is paid out of pension system investment returns, not from the state's taxpayer fuel general fund. Wishmeyer, 37, was recruited to North Carolina from the Indiana pension system in June 2010 to replace Pat Garrick, who departed in 2009 amid questions over her travel expenses and cell phone charges. Under Wishmeyer's direction, the state pension posted returns of 18.5% in the 12 months ending June 30, 2011, when stock markets were on an upswing, but a modest 2.1% of all of calendar 2011, when stocks went volatile. The system manages the retirement benefits and savings of 850,000 current and former state workers, teachers, and other public employees. His, Wishmeyer's, stay is one of the shortest I can recall, says Representative Dale Falwell of Winston-Salem, chairman of the House Select Committee on Legacy Costs from the State Health Plan, Pensions, and ESC. And our next article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. And along with this article, there's a picture of the outside of a building. The caption reads, 18 Seaboard and Tyler's Tap Room are among the businesses at Seaboard Station in Raleigh. The headline, Facing Foreclosure, Seaboard Owner Files for Bankruptcy. Downtown Raleigh Shopping Center 96% leased, but lender put call on $4 million note. The owner of the Seaboard Station Retail Center in downtown Raleigh has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in an effort to stall a Georgia group from foreclosing on the property. A portion of Seaboard Station, the 90,800-square-foot complex adjacent to William Peace University, as well as other properties in the Wake and Johnston counties owned by Gregory and Parker Incorporated, was used as collateral for nearly $4 million in bridge loans issued in 2009 and in 2010 by Georgia Capital of Atlanta, according to county records. When Gregory and Parker executives, William D. Parker Jr. of Clayton and Conan McLean of Cary, couldn't refinance the loans, Georgia Capital began foreclosure proceedings on the note. McLean says cash flow at Seaboard Station is strong, with more than 96% of the retail center occupied as of late December. That's when Tyler's Tap Room opened in a 10,000-square-foot space in the 18 Seaboard Avenue building. McLean wouldn't comment on the two bankruptcy petitions filed on February 22 by Gregory & Parker Incorporated and Gregory & Parker Seaboard LLC. We can't talk about anything while so early in the filing process, he says. Parker was unavailable for comment. Whit Marshall, a principal with Georgia Capital, did not return calls for comment. The bankruptcy filings show that both companies have less than $500,000 in assets against more than $10 million in liabilities. Among the company's largest unsecured creditors are the J.M. Thompson Company construction firm in Cary, the Jordan Price Law Firm of Cary, and J. Davis Architects of Raleigh. McLean is also listed among the largest creditors with $1.4 million dollars in development fees owed. Gregory and Parker has owned for more than 40 years the 6 acres of land between the historic Seaboard Railroad Station and William Peace University, and it redeveloped the property from a warehouse complex into a retail center in 2006. Among its tenants are Ace Hardware, O2 Fitness, the 18 Seaboard Restaurant, and a collection of locally owned boutiques, cafes, and studios. The property where Logan's Garden Shop is located is not part of the court proceedings because Logan's owns its property. Plans to build apartments on the Seaboard property have been delayed, McLean says. Real estate lawyer Bill Mann of the Ragsdale Liggett Law Firm in Raleigh, who is not involved with the Seaboard properties, says commercial property owners have limited options for refinancing properties in today's economic environment. There was a time when being a good guy, keeping your nose clean, and making your mortgage payments on time was all you needed to get a loan refinanced, he says. Today, if your loan-to-value ratio isn't where it needs to be, all that goes out the window. It's easier to get a new loan than to refinance with an existing lender these days, Mann says. It's getting better, but it's still not the same. Mann says some property owners are having to seek bankruptcy protection to protect their creditors' investments. I told one client that a guy in a black robe can do things you cannot do. Bankruptcy protection gives you some sort of workout option you might not have had before. Gregory and Parker's bankruptcy petition is not expected to have any impact on the pending redevelopment of the 111 Seaboard Marketplace building, says York Properties President George York. York Properties plans to begin construction work on the 20,000-square-foot former Department of Insurance office building within the next 2 weeks, transforming it into a 15,000-square-foot retail center leading into the entrance of Seaboard Station. York says he has lease commitments for 12,000 square feet in the building. Sola Salons will be taking 5,000 square feet for its first location in Raleigh. Operators of a new coffee shop, an organic cafe, and a green dry cleaning company also have signed leases for space in York's building. York says he is also in the final negotiations with a local restaurant operator for the building's corner space. Seaboard has got some really good things going on there now that we think we can build on, he says. Concerns raised about bill aimed at boosting startups. That's the headline on our next article. This article written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Raleigh. And also there's a picture of a man standing in what looks to be a cafeteria type area. The caption reads, Chris Gergen likes ideas to help foreign students. Though a bill aimed at promoting job growth has yet to reach the floor of the U.S. Senate, language regarding the transfer of discoveries from universities to the private sector is already stirring up controversy in the Triangle. The Startup Act, introduced by U.S. Senators Mark Warner, a Virginia Democrat, and Jerry Moran, a Kansas Republican, is based on a model submitted by the nonpartisan Kauffman Foundation. The bill, currently in committee, could see a floor vote in the next few weeks, Kauffman senior advisor Cameron Cushman says. The tech transfer element of the legislation would speed up the process of commercializing a product, Cushman says, by allowing innovators to choose where to license inventions and start the patent process themselves. Innovators at UNC Pembroke, for example, would no longer be confined to Pembroke. They could license products through other institutions such as UNC Chapel Hill, MIT, and Harvard. That's the part of the bill that has Laura Shoup, president of tech transfer company Funtech, and some of her colleagues skeptical. Our concern is the practicality of implementation, she says. UNC, larger universities, they are overburdened just by the technology they have. The bill doesn't address how institutions would prioritize licensing. Are they going to go offline from one of their own technologies and devote resources to the Pembroke one, she asks, adding that licensing outside technologies would bring about even more problems. They'll get less of a piece of the pie than they would if it was their own technology, and it would damage the relationship with their own faculty. Representatives of UNC Chapel Hill's tech transfer office didn't have a comment on the legislation. And Shoup concedes that her organization, Funtech, could benefit more than the universities. Professors could choose to go the Funtech route, bolstering her business. But it's not what I think is in the best interest of the United States in terms of economic development, she says, adding that she would prefer to see a centralized transfer program where all universities in the state system could license their technology through a single office. Besides the goal of accelerating the commercialization of university research, the bill would allow foreign students with graduate degrees in science, technology, engineering, or in mathematics from domestic universities to get visas. Immigrants who start businesses in the United States also could get visas under the proposal. The best and the brightest from around the world are already coming here to get educated, Cushman says. These guys are the people we want to keep here in our country. That's a facet of the bill that has Bull City Forward's Chris Gergen excited. We're home growing really high quality talent, he says, but adds that it's hard to recruit globally. In our next article, written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh, has this headline: New plans filed for old Kids Hill site. Charlotte developer working with Wells Fargo on new plan that's less dense than one okayed in 2006. Wells Fargo Bank and Charlotte real estate developer Pappas Properties want to restart a stalled development project atop Kids Hill near Crabtree Valley Mall that was abandoned by an Atlanta group 4 years ago. Pappas and the bank have jointly filed a rezoning request and a new master plan proposal for the 24-acre site known as Crabtree Village, which was the name used when the original master plan was approved by the city in 2006. The hilly site is located one block from the mall and is bound by Crabtree Valley Avenue, Blue Ridge Road, and Homewood Banks Drive, the home of the late Kid Brewer, a Raleigh politician who sold the land for Crabtree Valley Mall, once sat on the site. Wells Fargo spokeswoman Elise Wilkinson confirms that Pappas is negotiating to buy the property from the bank, which took ownership in 2010 following foreclosure. The Pappas version of Crabtree Village isn't as dense as the previously approved plan and saves more trees. The new plan for the property preserves the natural look of the site much more than the original plan, Wilkinson says. The proposed Pappas plan could allow up to 525 apartment and condo units, a 200-room hotel, up to 250,000 square feet of office space, and up to 60,000 square feet of retail space. The 2006 plan would have allowed up to 749 residential units, more than 410,000 square feet of office, retail, and shop space, and a 150-room hotel. Pappas Properties President Peter Pappas says the purpose of the rezoning is to lower the amount of required retail space and the number of apartment units planned. This is our first project in the Raleigh area, and our objective is to develop a community that will add value to the Raleigh market, Pappas says. We are very sensitive to the unique characteristics of the site. Kids Hill is physically imposing, with more than 120 feet of topical grade change, and providing expansive views of Crabtree Creek Valley. In fact, Brewer's home was converted into a restaurant for a period, with the patio overlooking the valley. Critics of the 2006 plan were most concerned about how development of the site would impact storm water runoff and water quality in Crabtree Creek at the base of the property. Areas around Crabtree Valley Mall are often at risk of floods during heavy rainstorms. Pappas says the group is focused first on building the 315 apartment units in six buildings, an investment valued at more than $40 million. Later, they could add more residential units, the hotel, and the commercial and retail buildings. Neil Rudolph, vice president of Crabtree Valley Mall's management company, Plaza Associates, says he expects the new plan will fit well with the properties around it. We've been here 40 years, and it'll be nice to have some company, he says. Both the new and the old master plans would allow one of the Crabtree Village buildings to be constructed as a mixed-use tower as tall as 200 feet, or about the same height as the 15-story Quorum Center office and condo building on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh. A public hearing on the rezoning request is scheduled April 17. Wilkinson says if approved, the first phase of Crabtree Village could be built out over the next 3 years. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline: Gas Tax Revenue Costs Rise. Rising fuel prices and resurgent vehicle sales are translating into more tax revenue to fund road building in North Carolina. But that good news is mixed with bad. Construction costs are also on the rise. It means that barring a dramatic change in the second half of the year, the state expects to collect $1.86 billion in fuel tax revenue in fiscal 2012, up from $1.65 billion in fiscal 2011. But not all of that translates directly into more roads and bridges, because gas prices generally rise and fall in tandem with prices for asphalt and other petroleum-based products, says North Carolina Department of Transportation CFO Mark Foster. The price of asphalt cement has risen 27% in the last year to an average of $615 per ton, according to a state index cited by ST Wooten Corporation, a large construction company based in Wilson. In 2008 and again in 2009, the recession shrank all three of the department's in-state revenue streams: fuel taxes, fees levied by the Division of Motor Vehicles, and highway use tax, a 3% levy on sales of both new and used vehicles. Foster says drivers are spending cautiously and conservatively, helping the department's revenue to recover only weekly. Drivers bought and registered 445,000 new vehicles in calendar year 2011, up nearly 20% from 2010, according to state data. But revenue from the highway use tax is expected to grow just 7% in the current fiscal year and 3% in the next. By and large, they're buying cheaper cars and smaller cars, Foster says. That's to avoid what the American Petroleum Institute says is the highest state-levied gas tax in the southeastern U.S. North Carolina's tax is adjusted on the basis of a formula that has a base levy of 17.5 cents per gallon, plus 7% of the average wholesale price during a recent six-month period. Based on that formula, the state's tax rose to 38.9 cents per gallon from 35 cents on January 1. The tax is designed to provide the revenue needed to build and maintain roads and highways. While federal stimulus funds help to replace some of NCDOT's narrowed revenue streams, the department pushed back timetables several times, Foster says, and the rebounding economy and tax revenue. Hasn't led the department to move any of the schedules forward, Foster says. Contractors are still feeling it, says Jeff Bandini, a partner at the Parker Poe Law Firm who represents construction firms. Most that did road work have had to diversify, Bandini says. No contractor can base its business model on DOT alone, Bandini says. They spread out their risk among several client types. In November, the state's House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bill to cap the gas tax at 35 cents, a move that would have saved drivers and cost the state about $96 million, according to estimates by legislative analysts. The Senate didn't act on it, but Senate leader Phil Berger, Republican from Eden, has said the chamber could incorporate a cap or cut into budget legislation this year. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read from the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. IBM layoffs top 1,200, says union. Job cut numbers at IBM continue to climb. Layoffs stand at 1,202, according to the Alliance at IBM website. And union organizer Lee Conrad says numbers could still be coming in. The area that appears to have been hit the hardest is GTS delivery application hosting, followed by GTS delivery distributed server management. It's unclear how many of those job cuts impacted IBM employees at IBM and RTP. The company will not release an employee headcount. The latest known number was 10,000, but that figure is outdated. Robeson County plant closing, laying off 95. At a time when North Carolina is trying to actively grow its military-related industries, a manufacturer of tactical gear equipment has announced it will be closing its plant in Robeson County in April and laying off its 95 workers. The plant facility for Florida-based Protective Products Enterprises Incorporated in St. Paul's is being closed due to business conditions, according to a WARN notice filed with the North Carolina Department of Commerce on February 27. The plant was part of the acquisition of Paraclete armor and equipment on October 14 by Protective Products Enterprises Incorporated of Sunrise, Florida, according to a company news release. Trexamet, Wright's sale, boosts Posen. Chapel Hill drug developer Posen Incorporated will look for at least one partner in developing a new drug for heart patients, but will come to the table with some bargaining power. The company reported a net income of $61 million in the fourth quarter last year, though that would have been a $10 million net loss if Posen hadn't sold off the royalty rights for one of its drugs. Because of the sale, however, Posen has $120 million in cash, which puts it in a better bargaining position when looking for a partner to finance the development of PA32540, which is targeted to treat patients with cardiovascular disease who are at risk of developing aspirin-associated gastric ulcers. And the U.S. economy grew 3% in the fourth quarter. The nation's economy grew at a rate of 3% in the fourth quarter, as growth in the private sector more than compensated for cuts in government spending, the Commerce Department reported Wednesday morning. The agency's first estimate for fourth quarter growth, which it published last month, was 2.8%. Eye Contact sold to Vocus for $169 million. And this article is also has a picture associated with it, a gentleman casually dressed standing outside of a building. The caption reads, Ryan Alice is the president of Eye Contact, which has been bought by Vocus. Morrisville-based email marketing company Eye Contact has been acquired by Vocus for nearly $170 million. Vocus will pay $91 million in cash, plus $9 million worth of common stock, and $79 million worth of redeemable convertible preferred stock. That's a total of $169 million in consideration, net of $10 million cash acquired. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. Our phone number, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.